2001 has become so big that its effectiveness can no longer be determined. Here's Nick Childs.
The Washington Post has published findings which it says suggest that it's impossible to judge the effectiveness of Top Secret America as it describes the community. It says there are now 1,300 government organisations working on programmes related to counter-terrorism, homeland security and intelligence, and perhaps more notably, more than 1,900 private companies. US officials have insisted that the reforms that have taken place have led to significant improvements. But recent episodes like the failed Detroit airliner bombing in December and the failed Times Square attack in New York in May have exposed continuing weaknesses and failures still to join up the dots.
The oil company BP has been given a further 24 hours to test the cap over a stricken well in the Gulf of Mexico. After it was lowered over the well to stop oil gushing into the sea last week, seepage has been detected from the nearby ocean floor. But a US official helping coordinate the response to the oil spill, Coast Guard Admiral Paul Zukunft, says there's been no sign yet of seepage in the immediate vicinity of the wellhead.
I will say that we've had no indication of oil being released at the site, and at the same time, there are measurements being taken. It's constantly monitored for VOCs, those are volatile organic compounds, and there is no indication that there's any release at, that we're seeing expressed at the surface.
At least 62 people have died as the result of a crash between two packed commuter trains in the Indian state of West Bengal. More than 100 people have been injured. A fast-travelling express train ploughed into a second train as it was waiting at a station early on Monday morning. The cause of the crash isn't yet known. World News from the BBC. Official media in China say persistent floods and mudslides are raising questions about the efficiency of the Three Gorges Dam. Hundreds of people are currently dead or missing in the Yangtze River Basin. Many hundreds of thousands have had to be moved, and vast numbers of homes have collapsed. In parts of China, water levels are above those registered in 1998, when flooding claimed some 4,000 lives. A Greek investigative journalist, Socrates Giolias, has been shot dead in Athens. Police are hunting two or three gunmen who, masquerading as security personnel, called at the journalist's home and began firing when he opened the door. Colleagues of Mr. Giolias said he'd been about to publish the results of an investigation into corruption. From Athens, Malcolm Brabant.
The president of the Athens Journalist Union, Panos Sabolos, said somebody wanted to silence a very good investigative reporter who had stepped on a lot of toes with his stories. Mr. Giolias, who was 37 and married with the young child, was apparently killed by a professional hit team. Gangland executions are fairly commonplace in Greece, but it's been a quarter of a century since a journalist was murdered. During the current economic crisis, there is a huge public interest in the exposure of people and organisations involved in tax evasion and corruption.
The philanthropist and Microsoft founder Bill Gates has called for a more efficient use of funds in combating HIV and AIDS. Mr. Gates told the BBC that while cheaper drugs were now widely available, the costs of personnel, consulting and facilities could still be reduced by greater sharing of knowledge. Mr. Gates was speaking from the International AIDS Conference in Vienna. The last of 250 British and Australian soldiers killed at the Battle of Fromelles in France during the First World War has been buried with full military honours. The final body, which was recovered along with others from mass graves, was reburied in a new war cemetery in the town of Fromelles. BBC News.
You're listening to the BBC World Service. I'm Paul Henley. Welcome to Europe Today. Representatives of 60 countries are gathering in Afghanistan for the country's biggest conference in more than three decades as they try to pave the way for possible pullout of European troops who are battling alongside others from all over the world to maintain some sort of stability there. The conference will hear from the Afghan government as it presents a grand vision for the future containing commitments both to its own people and the international community. But to many of the delegates, it's likely to seem long on hope and short on detail at what is a crucial time for the country. Our correspondent in Kabul, Lise Doucette, has been telling me more about what will be discussed, and I asked her first if she thought the whole event was overambitious.
Well, I think Afghans would say they have to be overambitious. This is a country which has been 30 years at war. It's been 9 years since the Taliban was toppled and the international community stepped up its engagement here. As one of the more independent-minded members of parliament here said to me, it could be the last hurrah. We're running out of chances to show results. But I've spoken both to some of the key Afghans who are organising this conference as well as to members of the international community, and they're in broad agreement. Afghans have to be given the chance, the resources to try to take responsibility for their own affairs. So they've organised a new monitoring mechanism. They organised a whole new way of structuring the government, and they're going to be held to account. There's going to be benchmarks, which, as the UN envoy Stefan de Mistura said, it's a polite way of saying conditions. The Afghans are saying, give us your money, trust us, and give us benchmarks. We're going to work together.
And how much trust do you sense that foreign delegates have in the Afghan government when it asks for more money?
Well, let me quote then UN envoy again, Stefan de Mistura. He says he's been in the UN for 40 years and he's never seen such a complex, difficult and dangerous environment. It's quite funny. It makes you smile in a way. So many foreign ministers now say, well, we never expected it to be Switzerland, which, of course, it will never be. This is a country which has a huge problem, even compared to neighbouring Pakistan. Its institutions are weak or non-existent. But still, it's got to start making a start on this. It's what its own people demand. And there is a growing Taliban insurgency across the country. I've heard people sometimes calling the Afghan government dysfunctional. We've heard very harsh descriptions of the Afghan president, Hamid Karzai, and some lacking in some key leadership qualities. But we've also seen Afghan government officials really being pushed by themselves, their Afghans and members of the foreign community, to try to come up with a plan for this international conference. And they will be under pressure after the conference to show that they can actually deliver. Because if they can't, then the consequences are just too dire to even contemplate for many Afghans.
I think there's a feeling of European governments itching to get out of Afghanistan, even those that won't say it at the moment. And the British government goes further than most in declaring their will to leave. How much of an impact do you think that would have if it happened sooner rather than later on the country?
Well, it's interesting because there are some who say, oh, don't give a deadline. It shows the Taliban that just confirms their view that the foreign community will eventually leave. It's just a question of time. But others who say, listen, Afghans have to understand they have to take responsibility. Interestingly enough, the year 2014, which will be the date of the next British election, is also the date of the next Afghan election. And the Afghans are also using this date. It may be overambitious, as you say, but they're also saying that they hope to be able to take responsibility by that date.
What kind of things do Afghan delegates say about the British, French, German, Italian involvement there?
Well, there's a lot of criticism of the foreign involvement in terms of any excesses or abuses by foreign troops. But I think, broadly speaking, a lot of Afghans know. Even members of the opposition groups, even the Taliban and some of the other groups, understand that if there was a precipitous withdrawal, that there is a real risk that Afghanistan could lurch back to civil war. And therefore, they understand that the Afghan forces, police and army aren't ready yet to take over responsibility for security. There still has to be what they're calling a transition period. But they know that more and more they have to be the ones who are in the lead. And this is why in recent military operations, you've had code names, which for the first time are using Afghan words like mushtarak, which means togetherness. It may be semantics, but it's sending a signal to Afghans, to foreigners, and to the public in European countries, where the public mood is very much shifting, that there is going to be a date. This isn't going to go on forever. I think that's important for Afghans as much as it is for those in foreign countries who want the troops back home for many, many good reasons.
Security for the conference, finally, is very tight. What does that mean on the ground?
Well, it means on the ground that in some parts of Kabul, there's absolute gridlock because whole sections of road are locked down. You can't get in. In other parts of the city, people have decided to stay home, so the roads are deserted. I have to say, in the many years of coming to Afghanistan, I've never seen such security here. The police who are taking the lead are calling it unprecedented. There are police in riot helmets at all the key intersections. But to give it another description, they're also planting a lot of roses at the roundabout and putting up Afghan flags because they know Afghanistan's face is going to be under the spotlight of the world. And like any country around the world, look at any European capital that's going to hold a major conference. They want to spruce up the place a bit, and Afghanistan is no different. They want to be proud of this conference.
That's Lise Doucette, our correspondent in the Afghan capital, Kabul. Well, joining me now are Jean-Pierre Molny, who's co-director of IRIS, a French research institute that specialises in security and defence, and Alexander Neil, who's head of the Asia programme at RUSI, a defence think tank here in London. Gentlemen, the two of you represent two countries with very different public statements on getting out of Afghanistan. The French government has more or less fallen silent on it. Alexander O'Neill, Britain is altogether more outspoken, correct?
Well, I wouldn't call it outspoken, but at least there's been some statement as to the timelines involved for British forces and development agencies in Afghanistan. It seems to me that, I don't know whether my French colleague will agree, but there's a bit of a syndrome of the ostrich heads in the sand at the moment. But the British political statements, although confused initially, are a little bit clearer.
What's been said then?
Well, you've had the Foreign Secretary give a statement about the long-term need in for a British presence in Afghanistan, and that was in contrast to the Prime Minister's statement that suggested a five-year timeline. Now, whether or not that was true or not, it was the perception in the public's eye, and the Secretary of State for Defence more recently has actually quantified that. The preference would be for a drawdown in 5 years' time, but there's an acknowledgement that to get the job done, linked back to the possibility of extremism in the UK, then we need to be in Afghanistan in some way or form for the midterm.
Jean-Pierre Molny in France, how does the troops' involvement, French troops' involvement in Afghanistan, play with the public there?
But in France, there is 3,700 troops in Afghanistan. The situation in France at the moment is that there is no debate on the question of Afghanistan, because more or less the government knows that there is no support of public opinion since we lost 10 soldiers after the French reinforcement in August 2008. But the situation is strange because as we know that there is no real support, we don't want to speak of this question in France because we don't want a withdrawal alone of French troops, of course, because we are with the Allies. Because one of the first decisions of Nicolas Sarkozy when he was elected in April 2007 was to reinforce the number of troops, French troops in Afghanistan. So now the lack of debate, it is the consequences that we are waiting, in fact, of a political new situation in Afghanistan to find a political
solution.
Yes, a political solution.
Alexander,
so we don't speak of withdrawal for the moment, but of course, the sooner it will be, the sooner it will be better.
Sure, Alexander Neil, these issues play big politically in all the European countries that are involved, but the truth is, whatever European delegates say at this conference in Kabul, we don't hold much sway. We have a tiny fraction, even Britain, which has by far the most troops there, has a tiny fraction of the US involvement. They're the players, aren't they?
I think that's true, but in terms of a coalition, you can look at proportions and relative troop commitments to the country, but the fact is that the UK is the biggest contributor next to the United States, and it's the greatest ally of the United States. So the coalition in that sense is extremely important, and Britain's role within it. It's undoubtable that the first people that the United States tend to consult with, and just purely because of the tactical realities on the ground and the chain of command, let's not forget, Britain does play a very, very significant role in this campaign.
Jean-Pierre Molny, there's big disagreement on the immediate prospects for Afghanistan, but most people seem to agree that it's a country, quote, in transition. Transition to what? Where do you see it in 5 years' time?
Well, I think it's a transition for the political situation. I think it won't be, it will be impossible to have in one part the current government and the other part the Taliban, because this war can continue during 10 years or 20 years if you continue as it was as it is today. So we need a political situation. The difficulty for the moment is, of course, to have a political solution. The forces on the ground want to have the advantage, and it's a difficulty. The other difficulty, and it's a fact that we are in a contradictory situation, because it's difficult to have a common position within the Allies, because on one part the United States, it's two-thirds of the troops on the ground, so of course they decide for all the Allies, and France doesn't have a great role on the ground with 3,700 troops. Okay. So it's a contradictory situation, because we can't play really a role on the solution in France.
Jean-Pierre Molny, thank you. Thanks to Alexander Neil in London. You're with the BBC World Service. This is Europe Today. Now, the airline industry was set up to defy the laws of gravity, but that's now an old trick. Now it's testing the economic laws of gravity, despite the constant reports of an age of austerity and travellers cutting back on their spending. There appears to be no shortage of optimism at this year's Farnborough Air Show in the UK, a window on the airline industry. Our business reporter Theo Leggett is there. What's it like, Theo?
Well, the sun is beaming down on this vast airfield, and it's reflecting the mood of the people exhibiting here. The array of machinery we've got here, we've got the double-decker Airbus Super Jumbo, we've got the Boeing 787, which Boeing is very proud of. The crowds have been thronging, and there's a sense of excitement, because this year, unlike last year, airlines are ordering new planes. We've had a lot of new orders today, a $9 billion order from Emirates, the Middle Eastern airline, for some Boeings. Air Leasing Corporation has ordered 51 Airbus. Airbus has got more than 120 new orders in total. It has been, by the industry standards, a good day. And that's because the global economy is improving, so airlines can spend their money on some shiny new planes.
You've been speaking to the boss of the giant European plane maker Airbus. Has he been reflecting that optimism you talk about?
He has, absolutely. I spoke to him in the shadow of the giant A380, the twin-deck Super Jumbo that's the pride of the Airbus fleet. And I put it to him that 120 orders on day one of the show, not a bad deal.
Not at all a bad start. Excellent start. And I think it just proves that the market is indeed recovering.
On the other hand, Boeing has stolen your thunder a little bit with the launch or the arrival of the 787 Dreamliner yesterday. Do you feel that you've been overshadowed?
No, not at all. I mean, the 787 had to arrive one day, so it's now here in Farnborough. It's certainly an interesting plane. Well, we've brought also our newest, hottest military plane, the A400M, and it's even been flying today.
The A400M, that would be the military plane that's several years overdue and several billion euros over budget.
Yeah, we were a little bit promising too much to the customers. I think the development so far has been going well, but we committed to a shorter time scale, we committed to a lower budget, and that was a problem. This is why we had to renegotiate with governments earlier this year. But I think we found now a good basis to continue this great project.
But do you think it will find enough buyers, given the climate of austerity in Europe, where defence spending is being squeezed?
Well, yeah, I think we got the customers in Europe that we can possibly find in Europe already. These are the seven launch customers. No, we think that this plane is ideally placed between the very large transport plane and the small transport planes for export customers, for customers outside Europe particularly.
Now, you can't come to an air show without seeing the Airbus A380, the enormous twin-decker Super Jumbo that Airbus has been selling for a few years now. But it's been selling rather slowly.
Well, you know, due to the crisis, we were not surprised that a lot of airlines probably hold back and said, let's wait how this plays out. But you've seen a huge order, what I call a vote of confidence by Emirates just a couple of weeks ago in Berlin. That was particularly remarkable because that's an airline that's operating the 380 already since roughly 2 years. So we obviously are very happy. Their business model with the 380 works, and they have now, all in all, 90 planes on order, 11 delivered, so 79 to go.
But you're still a couple of hundred aircraft short of breaking even on this, or so I'm told.
Yeah, this will come. I'm quite confident that we are picking up momentum again, particularly, as I say, with the first customers, the launch customers. We have now 5 airlines that are operating, 33 are in revenue service already. Everybody is full of brace, the customers, and also the real customers, the passengers, which is what counts. Load factors are up, costs are down. So it just shows what we have promised, that this is a great revenue and cash machine for airlines.
So you don't agree with the critics who have said that this is nothing but a white elephant, a super jumbo mistake, if you like?
Oh, this is a cheap shot. I mean, talk to the airlines. I don't need to defend this airplane. Talk to Emirates, talk to Lufthansa, Air France, Qantas, Singapore, and we'll tell you what they think about this plane.
And that was Tom Enders, the chief executive of Airbus there. And with that, that's it from me from a hot, noisy and very busy Farnborough airfield.
Theo Leggett, thank you very much. You're with the World Service. Now, the new British Prime Minister has called it his plan for a big society. David Cameron says he wants to turn government completely on its head and hand real power to members of the public and voluntary groups who can run public services such as post offices, libraries, transport and housing projects.
The rule of this government should be this. If it unleashes community engagement, we should do it. If it crushes it, we shouldn't. The success of the big society will depend on the daily decisions of millions of people, on them giving their time, their effort, and even money to causes around them. Government cannot remain neutral on that. It must foster and support a new culture of voluntarism, of philanthropy, and of social action.
Now, the Prime Minister's political opponents say it's a badly thought-out cover for cutting the amount of money the government spends on the same services. In a moment, we're going to get an alternative European perspective from Norway, a country where state control of things tends to be very much the norm. First, joining me is Conservative MP, Government MP David Willetts, who's Minister of State for Universities and Science. Mr. Willetts, this is David Cameron's great passion, as he puts it. What does this big society mean to you?
What it means to me is that we're going to strengthen all those institutions and communities that stand between the individual and the state and give life so much of its meaning. And we all know that, be it the family, the neighbourhood, the friends at work, the friends locally, the people that we share an area with, that's where a lot of real life is lived. That's where life is often most satisfying. And yet the experience in Britain in the past decades has been those have been more and more threatened by the extension of the state. We want to push the state back so that there's more space for these institutions to thrive.
But specifically, what will it involve? If you like reading books and you've been to your library and don't think it's very well run, are you going to take over running it?
If the local community does want to have a greater say in the running of their own library, absolutely, yes.
But they're not qualified for it, surely?
I think that being qualified is often an obstacle to proper empowerment, and I don't believe myself that being properly qualified is the be-all and end-all of everything. If someone's doing heart surgery, yes, but when it comes to something like the pattern of local provision in a library, I really do think that local voices matter. And to make this more real, what we are announcing today is that we are using the unclaimed money that is built up in dormant bank accounts to finance what we're calling a big society bank that's going to help finance social enterprises and charities.
Which
and
is a good
groups.
Headline as well, and there's a lot of very grand-sounding philosophy, but aren't there hard-nosed politics too? You're saving money and you're distracting from all the news about the cuts.
Well, I mean, Britain does have a fiscal crisis. We do need to hold down public spending because of the position we've inherited. But this policy is something that David Cameron cares passionately about, and he was arguing for passionately long before the fiscal crisis hit Britain. And we ultimately are doing it not because of money, but because we think it enables people in Britain to lead more satisfied, more fulfilled lives.
David Willetts, if you could just hold on there for a moment. I want to go to Norway and hear from Jan Egeland, who's a former Norwegian deputy foreign minister. He's from the Social Democratic Party, as well as a former head of the Norwegian Red Cross. Mr. Egeland, how would this policy go down where it's suggested, where you are?
Well, I think the importance of voluntarism is now undisputed all over. Also in Norway, we need more of it. We need more of it all over Europe with an aging population, greater demands for services, and pressed public coffers. There's not enough money to pay for it all. My big worry is that voluntarism cannot really substitute the state, the government, if you want universal and uniform services for everybody.
Okay, so you have to pay for those things out of the state. It's all about tax then, is it? We should go to Norwegian tax levels in this country.
Well, I mean, Norway is, of course, in the very fortunate position, too, though, to have been able to save the oil fortune. So it has a surplus.
And a small population, and it's rich.
And it's rich, and it has basically a consensus around high taxes, because everybody says there must be minimum services for all. But there are two problems also here. We don't have enough people to really staff all of the public services. I think in Britain, like in Norway, we cannot expect to be in school and university for 30 years, then work for 30 years, and then play bridge for 30 years on a state or a private pension.
Jan Egeland, thank you.
There is enough money for that. There are enough people.
A quick final word to David Willits. Will there be the army of volunteers that you need, yes or no?
There are lots of people who want to do this. And in terms of what Jan Egeland said, yes, our services have to be universal, but no, they don't have to be uniform.
All right, thank you very much indeed. That's Government MP David Willits, a minister, and Jan Egeland, a former foreign minister from Norway. If you've got an opinion on the big society and how it will work, will people come forward to do it? Will the right people come forward to do it? If you have the time, will you have the ability and the dedication to change society? World, have your say at bbc.com, or you can find us on Facebook. Europe Today is the name of our page. You're with the World Service. Stay tuned.
If you're new to the BBC World Service and are trying to work out what's on when, we've got a neat little way to help you. Go to bbcworldservice.com and click How and When to Listen.